So thank you for the opportunity to be here. It's great. So I'm, as the title says, I'm going to talk about connecting inflation to, in general, things other than the CMB. I know it's a very broad description, but I'll try to narrow it down as the talk progresses. So essentially, usually all the information, or most of the information we get from here, comes from the cosmic microwave background, of course, large-scale structure as well. And my kind of question to myself is, what else can we use in those decades of energy scales and various phenomena that happened to learn something about inflation, and even more specifically, the period that immediately followed inflation, so reheating or preheating, which is the period where the inflaton kind of dumped its energy onto the particles that we're made of. So in general, we all know that inflation has passed all the experimental tests that we threw at it. It solved the horizon flattens and monopole problems. The fluctuations that we see from the CMB to galaxies and everywhere in between were just born as quantum fluctuations and stretched to cosmological proportions. The predictions of inflation are, in general, model dependent, but some general themes are that they're largely Gaussian, at least for the simple models. You have to work a bit to get them to be non-Gaussian. And there's a nearly scale invariant spectrum, but whose details, of course, are very model dependent. And as far as we know, Planck agrees quite well, even with the simplest models of inflation. So the things we do to probe it, in general, we look for, again, as a person working on inflation, I try to distill all the data I get from all those wonderful experiments into kind of a few numbers. So tensor modes and scalar modes are two of the signatures we look for. Tensor modes are, in general, again, there are, usually with inflation model building, whatever statement you do, there is always a counter argument, like a model that evades it. In general, tensor modes probe the energy scale of inflation. So H squared, we have not seen them yet. We thought we did, but we haven't. And scalar modes also probe the velocity of the inflaton. So the tensor scalar ratio, this magic number, R, essentially is somehow proportional to the speed of the inflaton. So to get a large R, let's say at the 0.1 level, and by 0.1 I mean 0.07, 0.05, so that ballpark, which is still viable, we would need the inflaton to, in some units, to roll quickly. So phi dot to be large, in some sense. And again, we know that inflation has to go on for 60 or 65 EFOLs, so we need the inflaton to roll long. So something that rolls quickly and long will traverse a great distance. Well, all that thing can be easily formulated using the Lithe bound, which connects the number of EFOLs to the delta phi, is the distance in field space, phi the inflaton, and R is the tensor scalar ratio, again, for simple inflationary models. And in general, there's a question that might arise if we require R to be 0.05 and N to be something like 60, then delta phi starts being super Planckian. So there's a question that arises, is that theory that I'm describing now UV sensitive? So what do I mean by UV sensitivity, or the so-called eta problem, is that if we think of inflation as just an effective field theory, there will be the terms we usually write down, plus some tower of Planck suppressed operators. Now, Planck suppressed operators in general are good because they're Planck suppressed. But if you start having Planckian or super Planckian field excursions, then Planck suppression is just words. It doesn't mean anything because there's no suppression. Delta phi or phi would be bigger than the Planck scale, which means that your potential essentially is dominated by those UV terms, and we spoil the flattens of the potential. We might even spoil the inflationary mechanism itself. So there is a problem of how to control all that tower of UV corrections on the theoretical side. And the answer comes in form of an axion, which is 100% effective in UV removal. So essentially what we do is we can postulate a shift symmetry for the inflaton, meaning that the inflationary action will be invariant to phi goes to phi plus c, c being a constant. And that means that all UV corrections will be kind of absent, will be kind of illegal in that symmetry. Well, however, that imposes a slight problem, that the only thing you can write down that observes a shift symmetry is a constant. So V equals V naught, which is a bit problematic for inflation because it never ends. Well, however, okay, we can go a bit more into serious model building, and we say that the shift geometry has to be softly broken, right? So the initial proposal by Friis and Olinto was natural inflation, where you break it by you break the shift geometry by instanton effects. There's axiom anodromy models, which have nice features that I might come to at the end. But for kind of illustrative purposes, I will just use chaotic inflation. I will just use a half m squared phi squared potential. As m goes to zero, the shift symmetry is restored. So this is a technically natural choice. But mostly, you can think of it as sort of a toy model, for example, for axiom anodromy near the bottom. So it's axiom anodromy is a potential that starts as quadratic and then goes to be linear. And I will comment on the differences, but in general, quadratic inflation is all we need to kind of highlight the things that happen towards the end of inflation. So another nice thing, again, from a model building side, this is a fantastic thing, that axions do for you is that they severely restrict the couplings you can write down. You cannot couple it to anything however you like, which is great. We only have so many things to consider. And essentially, the lowest dimension five operators that I can write down are derivative couplings, derivatives respect shift symmetries, to gauge fields and fermions. So I will try to, and you know, based on an EFT way of thinking, those two couplings must be there. So I'll look at each of them on its own. So first of all, let's forget about fermions and focus on gauge fields. So again, for simplicity, I'll just consider the simplest gauge field we have, a U1 gauge field, so abelian. And one reason for that will be also that I would like to think of it as the hypercharge gauge field of the standard model. But for now, let's just be agnostic and we say we have an abelian U1 gauge field. So we can use the usual thing. We can decompose it into polarizations, plus and minus. And the nice thing is, if we write down, once we write down the equation of motion for A, for the field, we see that the effective frequency is actually dependent on the polarization of the gauge field. Essentially, the axion we couple it to is a pseudoscalar, so it breaks parity. So here I do sort of a teaser of what's going to happen. The blue and red line are the two polarizations for a zero gauge field coupling. So this alpha over F is zero. Nothing happens, they're conformally coupled, they don't even know the universe is expanding, they happily oscillate in their ground states. However, we then turn on the coupling, right? We turn on alpha over F, and the blue and red become green and brown. Zero is the end of inflation. So we can see, first of all, both green and brown are exponentially enhanced. Brown is much less enhanced than green, so one polarization is much less enhanced than the other, and one polarization is only enhanced after the end of inflation, whereas the other one is enhanced during the during inflation. Whenever we start seeing exponential enhancement, there's the obvious question that comes into mind. Okay, you dump a lot of energy into something, you create a lot of that, won't that back react on your inflaton? Or on your mechanism for creating it? Well, the answer is yes, of course. It will severely back react. Gauge field source density fluctuations by back reacting on the inflaton through the usual axion photon interaction. So this is nothing new on the theoretical side. This is the kind of the Feynman diagram we use to try to hunt for solar axions, in which case we have a strong B field. We wait for an axion to come in our magnet, interact with the B field and give us a photon. Here we have the opposite. We produce a bunch of gauge fields and we want to see how they scatter off our inflaton. And essentially, the equation of motion for inflaton fluctuations, delta phi, turns from a nice harmonic-like oscillator, so the blue part is the kind of harmonic oscillator-like behavior, to a forced harmonic oscillator, right? The red part is the sort of the forcing. So there are two constraints that we can use from observations so far to limit the value of alpha over F. One is non-Gaussianity at the CMB, because the fluctuations that the red part will induce on the blue part, let's say, will be non-Gaussian, so that has a bound, and also primordial black hole production. And the reason for that is, again, to lowest order, as a kind of linear estimate, the gauge fields will be exponentially enhanced by alpha over F, the coupling, times phi dot over H. Phi dot is the inflaton velocity. So we see that the enhancement will be maximal towards the end of inflation, right? So where phi dot stops being small, epsilon starts being one, the field speeds up. So we expect that the fluctuations towards the end of inflation will be big enough that they might lead to over-densities in the scalar field, in the action field, to cause primordial black hole production. So both of them taken together give us an alpha over F, something like 100 inverse M Planck's as a limit, as a conservative limit. So we are gonna stay safely below that. So the maximum amount of coupling I'm gonna show you is something like 60 or 65. So we're something like an order of two below what is currently, or what has been from linear theory, the limit of the coupling. But since we wanna start probing the kind of large back reaction regime, we are gonna use lattice simulations.
Sorry, yes. This is for perturbations, I guess.
Yes,
so
yes.
The background, because there will be also a back reaction in the background, and
yes,
there will be a smaller effect, or?
That is not, I mean, in linear theory, that was not considered, but I'll show you, I mean, lattice simulations have been, we have captured the background thing.
But isn't just average of E dot V, that would be, yeah. I mean, you could do it in the next order, in the second order.
Sure.
Just background is how big is that average of E dot V, right?
Right. I mean, it's in a, yeah, you can do sort of a Hartree-Fock type thing,
yeah.
And that is smaller. I mean, it's for the CMB, it doesn't even matter. And towards the end of inflation, because, you know, I mean, all your slow rolls start breaking down, those are even kind of not very good estimates to begin with.
Okay,
so first of all, let's start with reheating efficiency. So how quickly, how efficiently can you dump the energy of the inflaton into gauge fields? So here I plot rho E and M, I call it E and M, so rho gauge over rho total as a function of the scale factor, so inflation ends at A equals 1. So we see that for alpha over F equals 35 or 40, we get kind of a small fraction of the energy density going into gauge fields. However, for something like 45 and above, we get almost instantaneously the entirety of the energy density of the inflaton being dumped into gauge fields, just due to this tachyonic amplification. And remember, 45 is, again, factor of 3 lower than 110. Okay, now let's go into the details of the calculation and see exactly what's going on. As if this wasn't enough to convince you of the lattice simulation need, let's actually look at the two different polarizations. So remember I told you before that one polarization will be exponentially bigger than the other, just because one starts being created during inflation, so it undergoes a much stronger tachyonic resonance than the next. So in the upper line, I have a no back reaction result, so we artificially shut off back reaction. And below, we have the full back reaction and coupling of the gauge fields to the inflaton. So in the from left to right, we start here with low coupling, so alpha over F equals 35. We see the blue and the red are the dominant and the subdominant polarization modes, and we see they are exponentially different, and nothing much changes when you turn on back reaction. So blue and red are roughly the same in the two plots. So for low couplings, as you would expect, linear calculations are fine. We didn't even need to do that. And all the kind of intuition we have from simple kind of tachyonic and parametric resonance calculations are fine. Then we start going to 45, which is kind of the first value that gives us instant preheating. We can see again, if we turn off the back reaction, there's an exponential difference in the two polarizations. However, if we turn on back reaction, then you know we start seeing that the second polarization is very efficiently produced. Essentially what happens is the dominant polarization scatters off the inflaton condensate and creates the second polarization. And if we go to even higher, to 60, again, an order of two smaller than 110, which is the limit, for example, from Wrong-Gaussianities, we see that there's such an efficient kind of rescattering of the dominant polarization of the inflaton that for subhorizon scales, you almost wipe out polarization, which only kind of exists for lower K modes.
That's in the fluorescence.
Yes.
So that where the kink is that the horizon scale at the end of inflation or what?
This?
Yeah.
No. This is, thank you. This is essentially this is defined by K over A minus alpha over F, K over A phi dot equals zero. So for alpha, so essentially order of magnitude, This is alpha over f.
Is it bigger or smaller than alpha over f?
Oh, it's bigger.
It's bigger.
Yes, 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 yes.
So this is supposed to be like observable. I mean, this is supposed to be the spectrum of observed gravitational waves or tensor modes. Is that the idea?
Well, this is gauge fields. It's not tensor modes.
Why does it say sub horizon then?
Right, so you
said
this is just
gauge field. Yeah, these are kind of electromagnetic fields or hypertrophic fields.
Sub-horizon
is here, super-horizon is here. Sorry, the other way around. Sub-horizon is here, super-horizon is here.
Okay.
So horizon is roughly, okay, oh, a half m phi. So yeah, most of the magic happens on sub-horizon scales. Okay, so now we have, so what do we know? We know that you can dump a lot of energy into gauge fields, you can do it effectively, and you have to be careful about polarization, because polarization matters. If you go to the strong back reaction regime, your naive estimates of polarization are wrong, and you have to do that simulation to capture it. Okay, why am I going through that? What are we gonna do with it in the aspect of diverse observables? So one observable we have from the universe are intergalactic magnetic fields. So there are effects of observing distant blazars that make us believe that there's magnetic fields covering sort of the intergalactic medium. So what observations are these? So blazars essentially have a characteristic TV emission of photons. And those TV photons in the intergalactic medium can just pair produce into E plus E minus pairs. So those E plus E minus pairs, assuming there's no B fields, those E plus E minus pairs will be collimated with initial gamma, with initial TV photon, and they will upscatter CMB photons into the GEV range. So essentially what you expect to see is, you expect to see the theoretically computed TV brightness to be reduced, and the kind of the thing that is deficit here will be a GEV bump. So you expect to see a suppression of the TV bump and the generation of a GEV bump to exactly be the, you know, the photons you lost to pair production, which then give you GEV photons from the CMB. However, we see half of that. We do see that the TV kind of spectrum is suppressed, but we don't see the GEV spectrum. So how can that be? So one reason to get rid of that is if you put the whole system in a magnetic field, then the E plus E minus pairs will stop being collimated, so will turn in the magnetic field. And when they do upscatter from the CMB, they will be kind of, they will miss us, right? They will be in different directions than the original direction of the blazar TV emission. And there's work on that. One of the kind of seminal papers, as far as I understand, is they work on Taylor, Wofkin, Neronov, where they also created this curve of what cosmological intergalactic magnetic field do you need to create this sort of phenomenon. And you can see that it's different based on the correlation length. So for smaller correlation lengths, you need something of the order of 10 to the minus. For larger correlation length, you need something of 10 to the minus 15 Gauss, if I can read right. And then as the correlation length becomes smaller, you need more and more B fields. So the question is, can we produce that? Right? Can we get to that from inflation?
So yes. I should mention there are a group of people here who believe this is just wrong, because these electron-positron pairs, they actually undergo two-stream instability when they go to intergalactic plasma. So they lose energy to the plasma that way instead of basically upscattering CMB photons.
So essentially there's no blazar problem.
That's also somewhat controversial.
Okay.
All the people here who are physically in this building, they believe that this is wrong.
Ah, okay.
Is that right?
But no, I think that people who are disagreeing with them are not in this building, so we don't care about them.
I mean, I'm not pretending to be an astrophysicist or an expert in that. So I would love to hear the kind of to hear the controversy. Okay.
I'm not involved in it, but there's controversy.
Okay, fantastic. That's, controversy is always nice. So what do the latter results give us? So here is the same plot as before, essentially, rho Enm over rho total. As we increase the gauge field to inflaton coupling, at some point within less than a nifold, you dump all your energy into gauge fields. And on the upper left corner, we see the resulting magnetic field, so B squared. We can see for the kind of lower couplings, the black dotted lines are the analytical calculations, so semi-analytical, just linear calculations, and they match fantastically well with the lattice simulations, as you would expect. But then at some point, once we go to complete preheating, of course they start deviating, and at some point, linear calculations are useless. And here I show the correlation length. And you can see that the correlation length doesn't differ very much between runs because essentially set by the horizon scale at the end of inflation. Right? So the gauge field to axion coupling doesn't really have anything to say about the correlation length of the gauge fields.
And rho yes. total is the background.
Sorry?
Rho total is background?
Yes. Rho total is total, is the full.
Is, means like inflation ends.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, rho total is, well, inflation ends at zero. And well, here it means when that thing goes to one, that all the energy of the inflaton is into gauge field. So the rho total equals rho ENM, or rho hypercharge. And this is all, I mean, this is all lattice. Okay, now, okay, what do we have? We have that we can get a large B field, upper left, and we know that all the energy density of the universe is in gauge fields. Okay, this is good and bad. The bad thing is, okay, we're not made of gauge fields, so somehow we have to produce some model particles. Well, the good thing is that if you populate the universe with gauge fields in at high energies, they immediately will scatter into some model particles, either through scattering to fermions or through scattering through the Higgs. So once you get this instantaneous preheating into gauge fields, immediately you have a some model plasma. Great. And the reheat temperature is very high. Now, again, going out of my comfort zone into astrophysical kind of territory.
Evangelist,
yes.
Question about the previous slide before you go on.
Yes, yes, yes.
So what happens to the circular polars? I mean, so you violated parity in the beginning,
right.
And you've populated the different polarization states differently.
Right.
Does that survive these standard model interactions?
Yes.
In some sense.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so, yeah. Some of them will. Essentially, the thing is, for example, to do that. You will only this only evolves things that can annihilate to give you scalars,
yep.
Right? So essentially, the polarization will survive. There will be some order one suppression,
yeah.
Maybe because maybe the unhelical polarization will decay and the helical one will survive. But in general, yes, it does.
So do you get a net circular polarization of photons,
yes.
After you have mixed everything up with standard model interactions? Are there constraints from the CMB on relic circularly polarized photons because Compton scattering doesn't get rid of circular polarization?
That is a good question. I mean, we checked the kind of the B field limits. But we have not, I mean, since this is, order, I mean, once we go to the standard model stuff, we all only did an order of magnitude estimate. But this is an interesting question that I'll be happy to look into that to see exactly if we can bound this model even more. So now we have a plasma at high temperatures, a charged one, and we have a bunch of helical magnetic fields, or maybe magnetic fields that are half helical and half not helical, so we have some combination of the two. Now, in a turbulent plasma, as I've read, there's a thing called inverse cascade, which what it does is it transfers power from smaller to large scales, essentially conserving helicity, and through that it protects the B field from decaying. So what we see here is the evolution of the energy density in a magnetic field for an unpolarized field. So you just redshift away. However. Excuse me. For a partially polarized field, initially you essentially get rid of the unpolarized part, and then it stays fixed. And in the Campanelli paper, the computation for that was made for a field that had a polarization of, I think, 1 in 1,000, right? Either 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000. So even if a small polarization remains, that will be saved. So essentially, the inverse cascade can protect helical magnetic fields until much later. And that's why a lot of inflation magnetogenesis models try to use helical magnetic fields. So I did tell you before, a few slides, that we sort of wipe out a bunch of the helicity. Now we have to go to that picture and look at it with a magnifying glass, because we need helical fields. And we can see on the right-hand side, on the two plots, what we can see here is the helicity as a function of wave number for different coupling strengths. And here we see the average helicity as a function of e-folding number. So we can see that the average helicity is sort of at the 0.5 level. So even though we have a very efficient rescattering and kind of erasure of some of the helicity, it's not complete. So we still get an order one helicity remaining, which, again, it's more than enough to give us what we want, to give us the inverse cascade. So if we put in the order one factors that we fudged, essentially conversion of gauge fields to charged particles, some order one fraction gets lost. Then at some point, once the electroweak phase transition happens, the conversion of hypercharge to electroweak, of hypercharge gauge fields to actual electromagnetic gauge field, we give us a Weinberg angle of 0.9. We assume that the inverse cascade starts immediately after inflation. So there's an, again, an order one fudge factor here. But given all these uncertainties, we get that we get sort of a B effective of 10 to the minus 16 Gauss, or said differently, a physical gauge, a physical B field of 10 to the minus 13 Gauss, and a correlation length of 10 parsecs, which if you go to this plot, that might be highly debated, it's right here. It's essentially on the line of being able to explain the TeV blazer suppression. Okay, these are good news, but what else can we get? So essentially, there is a viable inflation magnetogenesis model. We do need to work out, I mean, it would be great to work out even more the details of essentially taking into account all the plasma dynamics with the helical magnetic field. But at face value, it seems like we have a viable model.
Where does that 10 parsec come from? How is that calculated?
Oh, essentially, it's the redshift, it's the expansion of the Hubble patch from there to now.
From the reheating?
Yes.
Is 10 parsec now? That sounds a bit too big. Is it by this inverse cascade thing?
Exactly, because you do transfer power from smaller to larger scales.
So how does that scale with time, for example? I mean, because it's not the same for moving a scale.
No. I have to go back. I mean, it's like a page of algebra, but it's nothing. It's nothing terrible. Yeah, this was done like by hand, so no simulations were done for this. Okay, so we do have our gauge fields, our hypercharged gauge fields that then turn into electromagnetic ones. What else can we do with them? So there is a chiral anomaly in the Saturn model, but what it does is it can turn decaying helicity, hypercharged helicity, into baryon number. Now, I did tell you that in a perfectly conducting plasma, helicity will be conserved. But okay, our plasma is very conductive, but not perfectly so, right? So there will be a decay of hypercharged helicity, which means there will be a change in baryon number. And there were some papers written by very good colleagues about this, and actually that was quite a ride for us as well. Because before we wrote our paper, Fujita and Kamada have come up with their computation of that phenomenon, and the orange line, the orange dot there, is our model. So it gives exactly a baryon asymmetry of 10 to the minus 10, right where we want it. In the same week that we published our paper on magnetogenesis, Kohei Kamada and Andrew Long wrote a paper where they computed better the electroweak phase transition, and there was an extra suppression. So the model became kind of an order of magnitude different from what we want as a baryon asymmetry. And a few months after this paper, there was another paper that said, actually, the uncertainties of modeling the electroweak phase transition are so big that this dot can move within an order of magnitude. So essentially, we are still on a knife's edge for using primordial magnetic fields or primordial hypercharge fields to create the baryon asymmetry. This is not a clear statement. It's hard, but you know, we might be living on a knife's edge that might make it possible. So we need a much better understanding of the electroweak phase transition. Essentially, the problem is exactly at what time does the electroweak phase transition happen? So the hypercharge turns into a B field. It means that there's no hypercharge helicity seeding baryon number, and how the sphalerons come in and out of equilibrium to wash it out. So there's a competition of times there that you have to model very precisely to get an actual number.
Sorry,
yes.
Question. So here you're just assuming that there is a primordial magnetic field, and then the standard model is just a standard. You
know? Exactly. Yeah, nothing else.
I see. And then, I mean, you had lambda of 10 parsec before, now it's lambda is 10 to the minus 2 parsec in this plot. I don't know, I'm just looking at right down. It says lambda is 10 to the minus 2.
Right down. Yeah, this is a different, I mean, they did a different assumption.
Okay, that's it.
So they did not start from an inflationary model, they just put it in by hand, in a sense.
But would that make a difference? These are later numbers, like V naught to lambda. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is, would the same mechanic tree that you want to explain, the Blazar observations, would give you the...
Right now, as I said, the biggest uncertainty is the problem that Kamada and Long found in their other paper, that the liquid phase transition is too not well known, let's say.
You didn't say within an order of magnitude, would they...
Yeah, within an order of magnitude, I mean, if everything is pushed towards the right corner, then you start touching. That's all I can say. So it's not a clear-cut, easy answer. Okay, now you asked about the background, so I'm coming back to that. So on the left plot, I start plotting the actual background phi for different values of the coupling. This is a small coupling, so it happily oscillates, and it just dumps a tiny fraction of energy into gauge fields. Nothing interesting happens. Then we start cranking up, we start cranking up the coupling, and what we see is that the background inflaton doesn't even do one oscillation. So the tachyonic amplification during inflation is so effective at extracting energy from the inflaton and putting it into the gauge fields that the inflaton essentially breaks. And for the blue and greenish curves, you can actually see the inflaton rolling, then sort of breaking, allowing the gauge fields to redshift and then start rolling again. So you can see here that essentially inflation ends and then starts again for some time. Now, why is that important? Well, this is important because, first of all, this is a very easy way to do what's called trapped inflation. So usually trapped inflation, you need sort of a continuous production of particles and you have to tune certain parameters to get something viable out of it. This is trapped inflation without asking for it, essentially. We got it for free. As I said, inflation ends momentarily, for example, for the blue curve, and then starts again. So A double dot over A is positive for another couple of e-folds. What can this give us? So to see what this can give us, let me take a step back and think about quantum fluctuations from inflation in what I think is the most intuitive way, at least for me. So I'll go back to a paper by Guth and P in 82, I believe, where they introduced the time delay formalism. Essentially, what the time delay formalism says, again, it deals with simple single field inflation, nothing fancy about extra field or extra degrees of freedom. So you have a ball, the inflaton rolling down a field, the quantum mechanical fluctuation are just noise pushing that ball up or down. So if here the ball is pushed up, it will take longer to go to the end. If here the ball is pushed down, it'll take less time to go to the bottom of the ball. So inflation will end sooner here and later here. So that essentially encodes the spectrum of quantum fluctuations. And the important thing is that delta tau, the time delay field, or you can think of it as zeta, they're proportional to each other, is inversely proportional to phi dot classical. So essentially, once the inflaton field breaks, then delta tau spikes. Of course, if we want to have more fields, this is not quite correct. It's not phi dot classical there, it's rho dot. But anyway, the intuition, I think, carries over nicely. So what we can see here, we see that 1 over phi dot and 1 over rho, and we see that they spike once the field breaks. And what that can give us, it can give us a very narrow point of an enhanced density fluctuation spectrum, which can actually seed primordial black holes much more efficiently than previously thought. So here's a plot of primordial black hole production by André Linde, Sander Mui, and Enrico Pajer, doing linear calculations. However, and then this is where they came up with this 110 limit for alpha over f. However, even for 60, we get this spike that can have enhanced primordial black hole production. So it would be very interesting to actually redo the primordial black hole bound on the coupling using this extra kind of resonance, if you like, on black hole production, and see if actually that can be a viable candidate for producing primordial black holes that are relevant today. I mean, to do that, we would have to start shifting this point further deeper into inflation. I doubt that we'll be able to shift it that much into inflation without having a large enough coupling to mesh with the CMB. But we are trying to figure out how far back we can push it right now and how the black hole production will be altered. So closing up the first half-ish of my talk, gauge fields, a simple axion inflaton coupled to gauge fields can give us very diverse observables. Instantaneous preheating and efficient scattering to the CMB can give us very high reheat temperature. Helical magnetic fields, if that field is actually the hypercharged field of the Sun model, an inverse cascade might lead to seeding primordial magnetic fields that turn out to be the intergalactic magnetic fields we think we see today. And also there's an interesting phenomenology that we didn't ask for it, such as inflaton trapping and possible enhanced primordial black hole production towards the end of inflation. So essentially, at least constraints must be updated if no other information can be extracted.
So what scale
yes.
do these black holes form?
Sorry?
So what scale do they form?
These ones scaling. Essentially, what you have is you have your fluctuation exiting the horizon at, let's say, 1 eV before the end of inflation. When they come back into the horizon, then some of the Hubble patches will collapse into black holes. Essentially, they form.
Fraction.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the fraction will be essentially e to the minus sigma squared, like the. So essentially, those will form too soon after inflation to be relevant. They will probably Hawking radiate away immediately. They'll be too small. So that's why we have to push it deeper into inflation, let's say 5 or 10 eV into inflation, to get black holes that actually matter. But I mean, even bounding this, you know, those might actually spoil something. I mean, if you create black holes that Hawking radiate around the BBN, you can at least put some extra bounds on the coupling that are stringent, more stringent than what has been done with linear calculations before. So, okay, a small kind of aside, I was talking about a U1 gauge field now, but what if the gauge field is Higgs? What if it has a mass? Well, we know our U1 gauge field is not Higgs, it's massless, the photon, but we have SU2 gauge fields that are Higgs and do have masses. So as a toy model, let me consider a Higgs U1 gauge field. So you can think of it as a toy model for the SU2 sector. So essentially here, we see, again, these are linear calculations, not full lattice, but it gives you an idea. The gray area are regions where the thing doesn't preheat at all. And the different colors tell us how the end reheating changes. So the number of V-folds until the universe completely preheats. And essentially, we can see that as we increase for certain different couplings, as we increase the mass of the gauge field, we might delay or even completely suppress preheating. Now, the question is, where would the gauge fields get their mass from? Well, they would from the Higgs field. So the Higgs field is a light field during inflation, so it'll just random walk, right? It'll have a value that goes according to a probability distribution. Again, take this distribution with a grain of salt, because this is the equilibrium distribution for a spectator field with a lambda 5/4 potential for kind of infinite number of V-folds. So take this with a grain of salt, but we will use it nonetheless. And essentially what happens is that in different patches, the Higgs will have a different value, hence the gauge field will have a different mass. What's important about this is that this delayed reheating, meaning delayed or different or suppressed reheating temperature, will be space dependent. So what we have is we have a collection of patches that actually maps into kind of the Higgs behavior during inflation. We have a collection of patches with different reheat temperatures. So, and especially for incomplete preheating, what we will have is we'll have some patches that preheat completely, and some patches that reheat perturbatively. So we will have patches with vastly different temperatures. Now, why is that important? Well, first of all, this is important because the same phenomenon carries over to fermions. So if you think of Sun model fermions, they're Higgs, so they have masses. And assuming that, or as long as the mass of the fermion is bigger than the mass of the inflaton at the end of inflation, or actually less than a half the mass of the inflaton, then you block the reheating or the decay of the inflaton into fermions. Right? So you would have thought that you would start producing fermions immediately, but you don't. You will have to wait until the Higgs condensate decays, and then you start producing your fermions. And that leads into, again, a space-dependent reheat temperature. So in 2004, Dvalli, Grusinov, and Zaldarriaga had a very similar proposal in which they said that assuming that gamma, the decay rate of the inflaton to fermions, is dependent on some field sigma, a spectator field during inflation, then they could actually reproduce the CMB fluctuations during reheating. Now, in our case, we get it for free, right? The Higgs field is actually there for free. It's very hard to get rid of it, this phenomenon. However, we have to make sure that we do not spoil the CMB by this kind of extra patchization, let's say, of the universe. And what this can give us is it can give us a way to bound or probe the Higgs potential during inflation. So let's assume that if we allow the Higgs field to vary during inflation, to like random walk, to be a spectator field during the whole of inflation, then the fluctuations that come, the density fluctuations, temperature fluctuations that are produced during reheating are of the same order of magnitude or spoil the CMB. Then that means that you have to not allow the Higgs to vary during the observable CMB window. So there might be a secondary minimum that traps the Higgs and then allows it to move, you know, 40 folds after the end of, before the end of inflation rather than 60. Right, so this is sort of a weird opportunity to start asking questions about what does the Higgs do during inflation. And even if you go into kind of leptogenesis and baryogenesis models, then in general they are very dependent on the reheat temperature because of washout processes. So you might actually have space-dependent washout, which can lead to Barnard curvature fluctuations, change in the cosmic infrared background due to different star formations in different patches. And so on. So this is sort of an interesting way to start thinking of kind of outside the box of how to probe the Higgs at these high energies.
So that invokes the existence of a beyond the standard model massive gauge boson, or that works
no, no, no.
with W and Z.
No, no, no.
Or that's
no.
a different story.
No, no, this is also true for fermions.
It's also true for
yeah,
fermions.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Yeah, well, this is. The gauge field, in a sense, for the gauge field, it's more dramatic because where you had sort of instantaneous preheating, you can now shut it off completely. But so for fermions, it's not as dramatic, but it's much more generic. So as long as you have, as long as you allow the fermions to be Higgs and you have high-scale inflation, which is important because that allows the Higgs field to have a large value, then you can actually block reheating for up to 4 E-folds, let's say, depending on the Yukawa coupling between the fermions.
But the mass of the inflaton has to be less than the mass of the fermion?
No, it has to be bigger, it has to be less to be blocked. It's blocked if it's less. It has to be bigger to decay. Did I write it the other way around? No, as long as the mass of the inflaton is smaller than twice the mass of the fermions, then reheating is blocked, right? You cannot decay.
Okay, but I mean, doesn't that imply that the mass of phi is fairly low compared to what we expect it to be?
No, because essentially okay, thanks. The important thing is that MF essentially also depends on the Hubble scale. So for simple quadratic models, there's an MF in both of them. Because the F and phi. So the fermion mass goes like the Hubble's, the Higgs VEV, which goes like the Hubble scale.
Okay, sorry, you wrote that on the list.
Yeah.
So one thing which I guess you didn't mention is your gauge, even you want gauge, just get a mass from plasma frequency. So if you are doing the same reheating, there would be a plasma, which plasma
yes,
particles. That would be the mass.
We are trying to see how we can simulate that.
Okay.
Yeah. This is. I mean, we don't want to do the. I mean, that's the question of okay, how much do you simulate to capture all the physics without you know killing yourself. So we are actually trying to see what sort of what sort of trick we can play with the code to get to capture that.
Okay.
Because essentially, once you produce gauge fields, they will start, even during inflation, producing a plasma. So a plasma might actually start being present even like an E-fold before the end of inflation. And that might actually severely suppress, even quench the gauge field production.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that is a very good question, but yeah, we haven't been able to.
You're working on it.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, the easiest thing we, you know, if fudging won't work, then, you know, you can always go to scalar QED, which is kind of the next best thing to actually doing the full standard model. And it's easy to simulate. So for fermion fields, I'll run through them pretty quickly because I want to go to something else. So for fermion fields, we get sort of similar results. You get one helicity being produced over the other, and that net helicity in the standard model, for example, the standard model neutrinos, can actually turn into a lepton asymmetry. So you produce a helicity asymmetry, and then you can turn that into a lepton asymmetry once electroweak symmetry is restored, which means that then all you need to do is wait for that lepton asymmetry to enter the sphaleron process and be redistributed to baryons, and you can end up with a net baryon number just from inflationary leptogenesis. And we are working to actually, I mean, the reason why I'm not saying too much about it is because we're working on a concrete model right now to do the calculations, not with squiggly lines, but actually true and honest. However, there's yet another way to get leptons out of inflation, which is, well, it's quite interesting because we can, you know, we're gonna get the same thing in 10 different ways, it seems like. And it's very interesting to see what sort of different observables each one gives us. It's actually gravitational leptogenesis. So gravitational leptogenesis uses the gravitational anomaly of the standard model to produce a B minus L, a net B minus L number. So you don't need to bother too much with the formulae. The important thing is that the number density of the B minus L number is proportional to the difference in power of right chiral and left chiral gravitational waves. Right? So you need a net chirality of gravitational waves to kind of take it through that mechanism and produce a net B minus L number. Okay, now the question you can ask is, where the hell did I get gravitational waves during inflation that are helical or chiral? Well, there are two ways that I can, that I know, there might be 10 more. One way is if you actually use an SU2 gauge field during inflation, there's an interesting kind of tachyonic instability that can transfer power to just one chirality of gauge fields, oh, sorry, of gravity waves. This is a whole talk in itself, so I will not go into that, but we have written a couple of papers on it. And it can produce, Robert Caldwell last summer showed that this class of models is actually able to produce a big enough gravitational wave chirality difference to actually account for baryon number today. But within the context of action inflation, just a month ago or so, Peter Radzhead, Tom Giblin, and Zach Weiner at UIUC actually numerically took our old lattice simulations and put in gravitational waves on top of them, and essentially computed the gravitational wave power spectrum resulting from the seeding of HIJ through the transverse traceless tensor of the energy momentum tensor of the gauge fields that are produced in action inflation. And again, they came up with similar numbers. So you get a net chirality of gravity waves that is enough to produce the baryon asymmetry. Now, I have two or three more slides. Please bear with me. Okay, the question is, we do get this helicity asymmetry, and so far people have just assumed that we can get the maximum out of it and then transfer it to the standard model. However, there are a few kind of nice intricate things that you have to tune to get the correct thing. So here, I assume there's no washout. We produce the lepton asymmetry, or the helicity, the B minus L asymmetry, and I just want to see how it transforms today, how it progresses until today, based on the different reheating temperatures, reheating kind of histories, right? So here, I have a matter-dominated reheating, which is the usual thing. You have a massive inflaton that's happily oscillating in its potential, W equals zero, the equation of state. B minus L redshifts like radiation, the universe redshifts like matter. And in this case, what you see is to get a big enough asymmetry, 10 to the minus 10, what you need is you need a high scale inflation and high reheat temperature. So it's over that corner over there. However, there are models in which inflation ends and the universe is a radiation dominated kind of universe. Well, radiation dominated doesn't mean that it's actually made of radiation. It could be a lambda phi fourth potential towards the bottom. Or in this sort of SU2 type gauge field scenarios, the universe generically ends up in a bath of sort of dark photons, so like a dark radiation. again, expanding with W equals a third. And we see that, of course, for W equals a third, all that matters is the scale of inflation. The reheat temperature doesn't matter because, you know, the universe, the two components do not redshift differently. So all you need is high scale inflation, so you don't care about the reheat temperature. However, there's more to be said in the context of the standard model and beyond. And the important thing is the nature of neutrinos and possible washout. Because here, I assume that I produce the asymmetry and just stays there. Nothing happens. However, we can wash it out. Well, the first question is, are neutrinos Dirac or Majorana? Right. Because we know they have masses, they have to be something, one or the other. So let's assume they're Dirac. If they are Dirac, then B minus L is zero, right? No net B minus L number will be produced. However, right-handed neutrinos will be essentially sequestered from the standard model. So your Yukawa coupling is tiny. So you produce a net, no net B minus L number, no net lepton number, but you produce an axial axial asymmetry, essentially having a tiny component of dark matter made of right-handed neutrinos, somewhere out there that's too low to even measure, and the rest of leptogenesis proceeds normally. And actually, people have not, this is sort of close to Dirac leptogenesis, but not quite. Now, if the neutrinos are Majorana, then it starts being more complicated, because then you can actually have washout. We assume we have a heavy right-handed Majorana neutrino, and through interactions of leptons with the Higgs, you can actually have lepton number violating processes. Well, it turns out that we can compute the washout factor. So for zero reheat temperature, or like small reheat temperature, is one, and then it falls to something like 0.08, as we did numerically. And we can go into how we computed that if you want. So if we take this into account, then what happens is the following. You can see that for something less than 10 to the 11 or so, nothing changes, right? For T reheat 10 to the 11. For higher reheat temperatures, you get a washout of an order of magnitude. So what was 10 to the minus 10, now it's 10 to the minus 11, and so on and so forth. So for radiation-dominated universe, all you need is to keep the reheat temperature. And by reheat temperature here, I mean the creation of a standard model plasma. All you need is to keep that below 10 to the 11, whereas for a matter-dominated universe, the line that was 10 to the minus 10 is now 10 to the minus 11. So essentially, you need an even higher initial gravity wave chirality asymmetry to produce the same number of baryons. And there's actually something even weirder that people hadn't realized. So here, I assume that the heavy right-handed neutrino is too heavy to be produced. So it only lives in kind of virtual form in the washout processes. However, if we turn it around, we can allow it to be produced and copiously produced. And in this case, the opposite happens, or the opposite can happen. You can actually produce both of them, the our neutrinos and the heavy right-handed neutrinos, and then you can wash out the asymmetry in the kind of regular neutrinos, let the asymmetry survive in the right-handed neutrinos, and when the electron Yukawa when the electron Yukawa interaction comes into equilibrium, then redistribute that asymmetry to the rest of the standard model. The cool thing about that is that you get a sign flip. So the sign of the lepton asymmetry here and here are different. And that actually takes me to my last slide, which is the final kind of diverse observable slide, in which we were able to kind of connect, assuming we get a gravitational wave stochastic background spectrum from LISA or ELISA or somewhere. I mean, I can dream, right? And assume that it's helical, it's chiral, and assume that it has the big enough magnitude to produce, through gravitational leptogenesis, to produce the baryon asymmetry today. We actually have a sort of prediction, right? Right chiral gravity waves require Majorana neutrinos with these masses, because then we have to be here. Whereas left chiral gravitational waves require either Dirac neutrinos or Majorana neutrinos with high mass essentially being here. So what we did is we were sort of able to tie together things that seem very different, like the nature of neutrinos and the neutrino mass to gravitational waves from inflation in a kind of non-trivial way that hopefully will be open to, I mean, I'm not saying we can distinguish between neutrinos that way, but you can at least put a preference to one or the other model based on, hopefully, a gravitational wave discovery. in the near or not so near future. And I think that's all. Thank you very much. Yes.
So the chiral gravitational waves are produced during or after inflation?
No. During. During, and they spike towards the end.
Okay. So you get a blue at the end. So
yes.
Relevant. Scales.
Exactly. And essentially, for example, in this, it's much easier to see it in this model, which is, I mean, you produce the gravity waves when you produce the gauge fields that seed them. So the gauge field, the U1 or whatever gauge field, spike towards the end of inflation, so hence do the gravitational waves. So yeah, this will be much different scales than CMB, so that's why we hope that LISA or something else might be able to see.
It's very small scale then?
Sorry?
A smaller scale, if you are
going to
see.
But it's a very big telegraph or something.
Oh, yeah, I don't have it handy. It depends on the what sort of, well, it's very different, right? Because this is high scale inflation, this is low scale inflation. So you can play, there's a lot of leeway there, depending on the model you want to choose to produce them.
And the range is 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 16 at an average?
The range of what?
What power are we aiming at if it is detectable?
Well, essentially, I think if we hope to be able to explain biogenesis through them, then they will be detectable. They will be at the very bottom, I think, of the ELISA band. Yes.
So you're kind of invoking standard model interactions plus maybe one extra ingredient, you know. Extrapolating over 12 orders of magnitude. So if I start adding other states and things, I mean, does this all kind of go out the window, or is this to BSM physics that's not just a heavy right-handed neutrino, for example?
That's a good question. I mean, I think whatever you want to do, you can start adding other things, and you would have to specifically change the Boltzmann equations and resolve them. So I can imagine you can put some like stronger lepton washout, lepton number washout process that actually invalidates this. But sort of this is a minimally invasive scenario. But the Boltzmann equations themselves are very easy to solve. So it's not a hard business to actually start putting kind of more models into that and checking them.
So I guess I'm puzzled by what you're discussing here, because on the one hand you say you might be detected by LISA, but on the other hand you see it's a very blue spectrum. So then at some point, if it's a very blue spectrum, then the energy density could become very big if you go to a higher frequency.
No, it's a bump.
But where is the peak of the bump, basically? You said the peak is at the LISA frequency, or is it that much?
I can check later if you want.
But you're saying it doesn't violate the constant. Like
No. You can hide it from everything else.
Great. There are no more questions.